Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Connolly, Judge Klopaki, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning and welcome to our second oral argument today. Case is Howard v. Howard et al. Versus SunTrust Financial et al. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you choose to use that time for rebuttal. I'll just mention, even though we have this Zoom platform and we can see each other and we can see each other's names, we're only making an audio recording, not a video recording. So please do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. With that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed. I should just also mention, we were fine in the previous argument without having any technological issues. If it turns out that either audibly or visibly there's any glitchiness, go ahead and bring it to our attention and we can pause the clock and try to get the technology sorted out. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you may.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Eric Hansen and I represent the appellants in this matter, SunTrust Financial, Gulf Holdings, and Stephen and Nathan Sands. This case is an appeal from the Rice County District Court, and what is at issue is whether or not the doctrine of equitable conversion can be used to eliminate an easement that is referenced in a purchase agreement and is recorded prior to the sale of the property. The position of the appellants here is that ultimately the purchasers of the property knew what they were buying, were on notice of what they were buying, and the district court erred in using the doctrine of equitable conversion to eliminate the easement in favor of Gulf Holdings.
So, counsel, what was the agreement that takes this out of equitable conversion?
So I think that it is the purchase agreement, Your Honor, and
yes. Okay.
Reproduce that purchase agreement in our brief.
And that's referencing the Gulf Holding easement lease.
Correct. It says, okay. Subject to the communications easement lease rights of record through 2026, subject to telecommunications easement lease rights thereafter to Gulf Holdings LLC and its assigns.
So what are the terms that this purchase agreement recognizes that this easement will consist of?
I think that the answer to that is that that's found in the recorded easement itself, Your Honor.
Well, I'm talking about at the time of the execution of the purchase agreement.
At the time of the purchase agreement, the...
Is there anything in the purchase agreement that describes what the terms of this lease easement is going to be?
No, there is not.
Is there anything to indicate that... You could anticipate that it would be a 100-year encroachment on their property and that it would preclude them granting a similar easement to anybody else in that 100 years?
Well, I would respectfully say, Your Honor, that the answer is they know that there is and that it is subject to an easement agreement. And then at that point, our law puts the impetus on the purchaser to take a look. That's the point
What does the agreement consist of? Is anything in there that indicates that they could anticipate that there would be a new lease easement for 100 years and that it would preclude the buyers from entering into any kind of lease easement agreement with anybody else for that 100 years?
They certainly should have... If nothing else, Your Honor, they're on a duty of inquiry. They knew that there was an easement, and that's unequivocal on this record.
Yeah, but the point is, what was the agreement that they knew about when they signed the purchase agreement?
That there was an easement agreement with Gulf Holdings
LLC. Well, in fact, there was no easement agreement with Gulf Holdings as of the date of the purchase agreement, was there?
That's correct, which is why then we go to...
Which is what the district court went on. It said there wasn't an existing easement. And so no one would have any idea whether there was going to be a ending in a reasonable amount of time, such as the Midwest easement, or whether there'd be an easement that would encumber this property for 100 years, and not only encumber the property with an easement that would be drafted, but would preclude them from entering to any other easement or lease for that 100 years to anyone else. Those are kind of major items, it seems to me. Tell me why I'm wrong.
I don't really disagree that you're wrong. The question is, who bears that risk? And
it seems to me you bear that. You bear the need to come forward to say, to show how anyone could anticipate that that was part of the agreement, because that it would be 100 years with those limitations.
Because it's recorded. Because that's
our system. But you see, I'm talking about at the time of the purchase agreement, not sure. At the time of closing.
I am drawing a distinction between the time of closing, and I believe that that is a crucial distinction. That if you sell a piece of real property that and enter into a purchase agreement for the purchase agreement, then there's a reason why the purchase agreement basic under our merger doctrine goes away. And it's because that's ultimately what you get is the deed. That is the enforceable promises. And so before you go to closing, you have an obligation to look and make sure that there's nothing else recorded there. And if you take something and there is a recorded instrument, say it was another mortgage, then you're taking subject to that. That is our statute on race notice. And
how does that fit in with the concept of equitable conversion that provides that the way to get around an equitable conversion is to have an agreement that is in existence at the time you signed a purchase agreement?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think that this is an equitable conversion case. I don't believe that the Rice County District Court was troubled, as I believe you are, with the implications here, and searched for a doctrine to undo this.
Of equitable conversion mean you cannot, after you sign a purchase agreement as a seller, encumber the property because your title is now limited. You cannot encumber the property after the purchase agreement unless there's an agreement that the buyers are agreeing to that encumbrance.
Sure. And the point of that, the whole point of the equitable conversion is basically surprise. And we don't have surprise here.
You don't think a 100-year lease that precludes somebody from leasing or granting an easement for 100 years to anybody else would be a surprise?
Not when it's listed in the purchase agreement, and not when their realtor talks to the seller about it, and not when it's recorded prior to purchase.
Mr. Hansen, I did have a couple of questions. So as I understand it, it was the actual easement that has all the terms that seem to be missing from the purchase agreement relating to the easement was in the document, and that was recorded.
Yes.
It was a little unclear to me based on the record as to whether, and I know once it's recorded, and then it's everybody's on notice. Was there some question in the record that even though it was recorded, it wasn't searchable yet prior to closing?
I don't recall anything in the record regarding it not being searchable. I know that there was an argument made with relating to the appraisal, that the appraisal took place prior to the recording of the easement.
So it's just so that I'm clear, it's your position, Mr. Hansen, that you know the document was recorded and the buyers could have simply looked at it. And if they had looked at it, then they could have said, to heck with this, we're not going to close. That's basically your position.
Absolutely. Or I would extend that further and say, you know, when this language is here and they sign it, it seems to me incumbent on the buyer to say, let me see a copy of that when you put it together. And then they can make a decision about whether or not they want to move forward with the purchase.
And I certainly agree. Well, I mean, I think the issue for us is, you know, there's the contract and then there's the doctrine of equitable conversion. And I think the contract applies and takes it out of equitable conversion if it's clear, you know, what the contract states. And I guess I share some of the concerns of Judge Klapacki, you know, whether or not it put them on notice. You know, I'll give you that. You know, I mean, I think a diligent buyer would have said, what the heck's that all about? But, you know, I also think that the seller was not exactly clear in the contract in terms of the details of this easement. And so, for example, if it had said, you know, subject to a 100-year easement, which does not provide any rental income to the buyers, and that has been sold between Gulf Hold, and that has been will be recorded by Gulf Holdings to, you know, whoever, I've forgotten who has the easement now, blah blah blah. Well, then I would have, then I would say it's absolutely clear to the purchase agreement that this easement is on the property, and, you know, you buyer beware. But I'm not so sure that the language that you're referencing under other, and I will just say, you know, for me, if you were going to put this language, it should go in the language, it should go in that portion of the purchase agreement that deals with easements. I mean, there was some discussion of like a water easement. I mean, I'm not so sure this is where I would have put it to make it absolutely clear what's going on. So if I agree with Judge Klapacki that an agreement can trump equitable conversion as long as the agreement is clear as to what the terms of this easement are, why are we both wrong that since the terms are unclear, then the contract doesn't trump the doctrine? So why are we both wrong on that point, Mr. Hansen?
I think that I think that the problem with your hypothetical, Your Honor, is that where does the court draw the line? That if we had put it's a 100-year easement, does that mean
how about a language that, well, how about a syllabus point that says in order for the doctrine of equitable conversion not to apply, there has to be clear and unambiguous language located in the purchase agreement, specifying the terms of an easement. How about that?
So I would say that defeats the purpose of what our purchase agreements are for.
It just says that a purchase agreement. No, it doesn't. I certainly look. If there's anyone in the world who believes it's the purchase agreement and we don't get into other stuff, it's me. But I also believe that the purchase agreement has to be absolutely clear and unambiguous as to what's going on. And here, I mean, I taking aside your, well, they were on notice, I'm not so sure that the agreement is absolutely clear as to what the terms of this easement are and, you know, what it means, and so that both parties know what the agreement states.
I guess my problem, Your Honor, is that if you're going to try to draw a line on this and say, well, it's got to be clear, then what terms of the easement then have to be incorporated into the purchase agreement? I certainly think, obviously, that I win on simply the notice point. But, you know, if it said an easement of 100 years, does that make it more on notice? Yes. But are you going to have to say an easement with a legal description?
How about precluding any other easements covering the whole parcel for 100 years?
And
I mean, it just seems to me that those are major kind of things.
I agree that they are, Judge. The question is whether or not the language in the purchase agreement is enforceable if that language isn't there. And as I understand Judge Connolly's question, the question is, okay, well, if it had said an easement for 100 years, but say had lacked and it precludes others from an easement, maybe Judge Connolly concludes that that's sufficient and you still believe that that's insufficient. And my point is that I think that if we're trying to incorporate these things into a purchase agreement, I mean, easements are separate written documents with a substantial amount of detail and for good reason. And we don't roll those things into the purchase agreement. That's not the point of the purchase agreement.
Well, I mean, one thing you could have done is attach the, you know, well, you couldn't because it wasn't recorded yet. But I mean, does the record indicate whether the easement was draft, was signed between your clients and whoever the new easement person is?
At the time of the purchase agreement, I don't believe it was.
Okay. Well, I mean, one way to avoid this is to have the easement there and attach it as an exhibit to the purchase agreement. And then it's like, well, you know, then I would say buyer's toast.
Completely agree, Your Honor. But the question is, you know, that isn't our fact scenario. And so the question is whether or not we're going to let the buyer off the hook for basically ignoring this language that they signed in the purchase agreement that says that there is this easement. That, I think, is the question. And I don't think the doctrine of equitable conversion saves them.
Well, Mr. Hanson, I had a different concern with regard to the language. There's a reference to the Jaguar Communications lease. And if I understand right, there was compensation to the Servient estate owner for that lease. Am I correct?
Yes.
And then now there's this reference to subject to telecommunications easement lease rights of record through 2026. And then there's a reference to subject to telecommunications easement lease rights thereafter. That language, I guess if I were looking at it, you say it puts the buyer on notice, I would at least presume if I saw the reference to lease rights that there's some financial component, at the very least, there would be some remuneration that comes to the Servient estate.
Well,
why would these terms be used? Let me just tell you, it feels a little fishy. If I were, I'm not saying it was done in this case, but if I were a seller trying to use fudge language to be, if I was planning on a 100-year agreement that was exclusive and provided no funds at all in a traditional leasehold rent arrangement with the Servient estate, this is the kind of language I'd put in if I wanted to keep it fuzzy so that there wouldn't be any further investigation. So disabuse me of my concern.
So I think that where I would disagree with you, Judge Ross, is that if you take a look at the language in the purchase agreement, and we reproduced that in our briefs, and that's obviously in the record, that it talks about an existing telecommunications lease that runs through 2026, and it was acknowledged that that one was not providing money. Only the Jaguar lease was providing the $400 a month, and then that's what's put out there in the sale notice. And then the purchase agreement says, first, Jaguar Communications lease has been terminated. The stuff is gone. Two, there's an existing telecommunications lease that runs through 2026. Three, it's going to be subject to a telecommunications easement lease rights thereafter, so after 2026, to Gulf Holdings. And I believe that the answer has to be for our property rules that, okay, before I close this thing, if I want to know what these things are, I better go look. And that didn't happen. And so the question is, who bears that responsibility? Because I would analogize this to any other disclosure.
Can I move you to another question? Tell me why you believe Gulf Holding is a good faith purchaser with the involvement of Nathan Sand throughout these proceedings.
Why they're a good faith purchaser?
Purchaser, yeah.
I would
on the lease easement.
So I would submit that the court doesn't go through that inquiry.
Well, I'm going through it. So tell me why you believe Gulf Holdings is a good faith purchaser.
I think because the purchase agreement says that they're going to be the purchaser, and the people that own that the bundle of rights that have been transferred via this purchase agreement to the buyers, that Gulf Holdings understands that the people providing them the leasehold interest have the ability to do so, and the people that will subsequently own the land know that they're going to be there.
Tell me about Nathan Sands' involvement in this proceeding. I mean, he's the one that signed it on behalf of Gulf Holdings as a buyer on that lease easement. He's apparently involved in the negotiations for the sale itself, so that he was on notice of what was going on and what purchase agreement said. So,
right. And so when the realtor for the buyers reached out to him, he told him what was going on.
What did he tell him?
I think that's in our record, Your Honor. I don't want to misquote that, but it is in our record that conversation occurred.
Yeah, well, here's what the record is that I saw, that he didn't have an idea where the lease easement came from. He didn't know what consideration there was. He looked like he knew nothing about it, which is pretty inconsistent with his signing the lease easement and apparently being involved in the negotiations between the seller and the respondents.
Ultimately, Your Honor, I think, and again, we're working off of a record that came out of a summary judgment proceeding. So I think it's...
Well, that was the record from the deposition, wasn't it? His statements from his deposition.
Right. And his deposition is there. And that is the record that we have. I'm not arguing that.
Is there anything else in the record that would bear on his being a good faith purchaser? Or not his, but... Gulf Holding?
Ultimately,
he's effectively Gulf Holding, isn't he?
He's the principal agent, is my understanding.
Yeah, okay.
I know, Judge Ross, I'm well over my time.
But you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time. Right. So well, let's move on to Respondents' Counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Carl Christensen. I represent the respondents, the Howards. We've talked a lot about this already. The one sentence in the purchase agreement shouldn't amount to a windfall for the appellants. That sentence
Why didn't it put your clients on notice prior to closing to look at the public record? Well, they could have done several things. They could have said, what the hell is this all about to the buyers? And presumably the buyers would have said whatever they're going to say. They didn't do that. Or they could have looked at the title commitment, which showed that there's this easement. And they could have said, what's all that about? You know, let's look at the easement. Why doesn't the purchase agreement, which clearly references an easement, which your clients knew about from the title commitment as well, why doesn't that trump the doctrine of equitable conversion? Since your clients were on notice that there was an easement and it was up to them to find out either A, what it's about, or B, well, we didn't sign up for this, so we're not going to closing. And you didn't do either of those things.
Right. So our clients testified and put in the record that their understanding was that was an easement that was going to be to their benefit, that they would be negotiating sometime in the future. Similar to Judge Ross's question.
Well, I mean, you know, and not to mean in your face, but I mean, who cares what they thought? I mean, you find out what the easement is by looking at the easement. And, you know, they could have asked that question. So does this mean we're getting an easement now that's going to generate, you know, is it the same as always? We get $400 a month. I mean, they could have inquired, or they could have looked at the easement themselves, or they could have not gone to closing until this was cleared up. They did none of those things. So since they didn't do any of those things, why doesn't the merger doctrine indicate that, okay, whatever everyone thought is irrelevant now, they went to closing and they're stuck with whatever it is on the property? Why am I wrong?
Because the merger doctrine doesn't say that. What the merger doctrine says is that any unfulfilled conditions in the purchase agreement that at the time of the deed are deemed to be waived or otherwise, if they're not fulfilled, that there's some agreement there. But all of the cases that appellants cite to for the merger doctrine all talk about what the agreement was at the time of the purchase agreement. And here, there was no agreement. And the language itself, we point out in our reply, not only is the language inconsistent on what it could mean, lease rights, for instance, but even respondents' response to what it was that it was communicating, whether it was a specific easement or an easement to be created in the future, or it was a lease for telecommunications equipment, none of that.
Well, Mr. Christensen, one thing I do want to understand is it undisputed that this easement that's referenced in the last sentence of the other section of the purchase agreement, is there any dispute that was recorded prior to closing?
The prior easement, the one that's referenced that terminates in 2026, is that the one you're talking about?
No, the easement that says subject to telecommunications easement lease rights thereafter to Gulf Holdings LLC and its assigns. Is there any dispute that easement was not recorded prior to closing?
I have two answers to that. The first one is there's only two.
Either yes or no. I mean, so which is it?
Well, I can't answer that with a yes or no question, and this is why.
Well,
there was an easement recorded that purports to be to the benefit of Gulf Holdings.
Okay.
Whether it comports with this language or not, I don't know, because I don't know what that language says. I'm not trying to be a coy or flippant, Your Honor.
And theoretically, your clients could have, you know, once it showed up in the title commitment, should have, you know, either had the title company get a copy of the easement, which generally, you know, happens. You know, at least it is with most property that I was involved with in private practice. You know, okay, well, the title commitment says this easement. Where is this easement? And then you would have found out. I mean, your clients could have done that, correct?
That's correct. They could have done that.
Okay. Since they didn't, and you went to closing, why does this doctrine of equitable conversion trump those facts?
Because there's a better solution to this that would have comported with the doctrine of equitable conversion and the purpose of the doctrine of equitable conversion. And that is because they were the equitable owners at the time that this purported easement was entered into, they could have been presented with the easement for them to sign off on it. That would have conformed with the doctrine of equitable conversion, and it would have preserved the equities. And that is that at the time that it was created,
well, did the purchase agreement provide or have any language saying that between now and closing, any encumbrances on the property require the approval of buyer?
I don't know if the purchase agreement has that language, but that's my understanding what the law requires. And Your Honor, getting to the question you posed to appellants about the kind of language that could be here that could meet a specificity requirement, I would also argue that when it comes to a telecommunications easement, it would have to be significant. And here, let me give you an example. One of the cases that appellants cite to is a case about a road where there's a practical location issue because the road isn't specifically demarked as it went around a structure on the property. I can't remember if it was a garage or an outbuilding of some sort. And the question was whether or not that easement failed for the requisite specificity, and appellants hold it out for the proposition that you don't need to have all the details of an easement for an easement to be valid. But that's the kind of easement where it could be in a line like this, and there could be some recitation to a road, but it wouldn't have all of the I's dotted and the T's crossed to say exactly where it was. And that could meet the mustard of a something other than the actual easement document itself. But with a telecommunications easement, we have a number of issues that would need to be specified. And we point that out in our brief when we compare it to the previous one. For instance, what about access issues if they need to repair the equipment? Well, what happens in there's another case where there was a, a utility easement, and there was the property flooded. The question was whether or not the utility company went over its stay by being on the property and damaging the property. What about dispensation for that? What happens if there's a major problem? You need to access the property, and your ability to repair the telecommunications easement and the tower requires more space than what your actual easement is. What about liability issues? The previous telecommunications easement had liability, had coverage for the property owners in case something happened, and there's indemnity language for them. This new one doesn't have anything related to that. What about other issues? The FCC issues that tie into easement, utility easement, into a cell tower. None of it doesn't have any of that language. So I would posit that there is no way to reference a telecommunications easement in a summary fashion on a purchase agreement at the time of execution of the purchase agreement that could fulfill the specificity requirement for a telecommunications easement. And look at the original one. That's in the record. It's long. There's a contract and an easement. They're extremely long. So going back to what could have happened, what should have happened, I think you asked that question as well. What should have happened, the way to avoid all of this, is record the easement before you sign the purchase agreement. Then there's no question. But what happened here is a mess. And from our client's perspective, the question, first of all, the burden is on the appellants to show that they can establish an easement by either clear and convincing evidence, or that the language in the contract shouldn't be construed, the ambiguity shouldn't be construed against them. So they have a double burden here. And so when you look at that, and then you look at their statements about what was actually going on, whether it was an easement or their ability to have an easement, this gets in, and actually the duration of the easement, as Judge Klopacki was talking about, and the actual sophistication of a telecommunications easement, it all comes down to one sentence that then when you compare that I've already said doesn't make a lot of sense, but when you compare it to the other sentence, I agree with Judge Ross's observation as well. It starts to indicate that it's parallel with the other sentence. It has the same language, subject to telecommunications easement lease rights. The prior one was something that benefited the property. I would like to point out that appellants in the summary judgment motion and in this argument said that it was not a revenue generating easement. And we supplemented the record after the motion and put in an inquiry from Verizon Wireless that was asking about the state of the easement. So I don't think that is a fact. I know that's not a fact that's been established. There's at least a dispute on that. But looking at the parallel structure of these two, the previous easement was income generating to the benefit of the property holders, and the subsequent one is not. And it's that parallel structure, too, that doesn't make any sense. Now, we have alternative arguments related to easements and gross, and I would like to point out to the court, as far as I can tell, Minnesota hasn't adapted the restatement's position on easements and gross, and they're freely terminable. We analyze the language in there. There's some language that says that an easement and gross is an irrevocable license. There's other language that says easements and gross are revocable. The way that we harmonize those two is to say that as related to the parties that are subject to the transaction, and as long as the grantor has privity with the land, that's when it's irrevocable. But if any of that is changed, the landowner can revoke the easement and gross. And we would be looking for clarity from this court on whether it follows that precedent or it follows the version in the restatement.
Counsel, is there any case law that says or suggests that once real estate transaction is closed, that you're precluded from seeking a remedy based on equitable conversion?
No. And in fact, I thank you for asking that question, because that begs a bigger question about the interplay between merger and the doctrine of equitable conversion. Sorry,
well, and prior to closing, the remedy is you don't go through the closing. But once you've closed, and my question is, does that mean that you've lost any claim of equitable conversion?
No, the remedy for equitable conversion isn't merely that there isn't marketable title. The remedy is, and I didn't look at the cases specifically to see which ones came up after closing or before and which remedy they were, but I didn't find any limitation of remedies on that doctrine. And in getting
what is the remedy for a equitable conversion situation? The encumbrance that was created subsequent to the purchase agreement is simply stricken. Is that the remedy?
That's what we're asking for, and I think that's consistent with the doctrine.
Case law support that as the remedy?
Again, I didn't look at it from the pre and post deed remedies, but I didn't see anything that said I couldn't do that. My understanding was that the equitable doctrine would get us to any remedy that was consistent with it, and what it does say is that the case that stands for the general proposition of what you can do in equitable conversion is the
I gather it means to do equity, and that is you strike the encumbrance that wasn't agreed to at the time of the purchase agreement. That makes
right.
sense.
Right. So not only that, the Scheiberg v. Hansen case, that's a Supreme Court case from 1917. It goes through and does a list of things that the equitable owner can do. It says that that ownership interest can pass by descent. It's subject to dower. It's subject to a homestead right. It's subject to a lien of judgment that could be sold on execution so people can attach to that equitable interest. It could be mortgaged. It would pass by deed. So my reading of all of those remedies were that the equitable ownership interest gave certain abilities and powers and rights to the homeowner that likewise the seller didn't have. The seller couldn't do any of those things. There's one case that stands for the proposition that the seller doesn't have homestead rights. So the way I've looked at this is at the time of the purchase agreement, the seller couldn't encumber the property. And so that's improper.
But my question is, what if he did?
And that's why I said sorry, Judge, I don't mean to interrupt you. And I see I'm out of time. May I answer your question?
You certainly may.
Thank you, Judge. That's where the interplay of the doctrine of equitable conversion and merger come into one another. And there's also not a case that I can find that says the doctrine of merger would trump equitable conversion. And what we would ask ourselves then is that in the absence of a case that says merger trumps equitable conversion, in the absence of a case that says your remedies are only limited to any remedies that would be available if you don't actually close on the agreement, the end result is that we can't let the actual entering into the deed and the doctrine of merger to overcome or take away the remedies that equitable conversion allows.
Judge Ross, could I ask one more question?
Sure. Go ahead.
In these briefs, there's some discussion about Gulf Holding being a good faith purchaser. How does it bear into any of your argument or your analysis? What difference does it make?
Well, it makes a difference if the Recording Act statute is going to play into this. And appellants have argued that, and I don't quite understand the argument, but that basically because of the Recording Act statute, what happened trumps what we think should have happened. And in that instance, it would play in because they're not a good faith purchaser. And as the court has already pointed out, Nathan Sands' testimony basically gives no motivation for a significant revenue generating encumbrance on my client's property. But related to the doctrine of equitable conversion, the good faith would play into the equities under the general principle of, unclean hands, but there's no allegation that Howards haven't acted in bad faith. So it plays in a peripheral sense if they're seeking an equitable remedy. And finally, related to the other claims that we would ask the lower court to actually rule on, which is the slander of title, good faith or lack of good faith surely plays into that. We're talking about a false utterance on title with malice. That is another way of looking at the motivation of the of the encumberer, and indeed whether or not it was in good or bad faith.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you. I think that it's important that we start with the proposition that the only way we get to equitable conversion.
Just a quick reminder to make sure you begin with your name so we can keep the audio recording clean.
Thank you, Your Honor. Eric Hansen on behalf of the appellants in this matter.
Thank you.
I want to be clear that we only get to the question of equitable conversion if we conclude that there is not a contract that governs this. And I think that that is deeply problematic as a contention if we look at this contract and this purchase agreement. There is clear language saying there's an easement. It's initialed by both parties. And so the only way we get to equitable conversion and the remedy that the district court did here is to basically ignore what the parties contracted for. And I think that that is deeply problematic. And I would submit that ordinarily, if you were going to draw that conclusion, you wouldn't simply strike this provision. What you'd say is, well, there wasn't a meeting of the minds for this transaction, so we're going to undo the transaction. And that's not what the district court did here. The district court basically lined out a contractual provision and justified it using equitable conversion.
Do you think that determination about striking it and lining it out stands as a matter of law, or do you think there's some fact questions there? I mean, the issue is, was there an agreement that takes it out of equitable conversion? And the question is, what is that agreement? Are there fact questions about that?
I would say there is not the fact questions about that. I think that that you would have to conclude that contract was ambiguous, and then there was a fact question as to what was the intent of the parties.
As I read your brief, I thought you conceded that there could be fact questions on that issue, but maybe have you changed your mind, or what are you telling me?
I understand that if you follow the logic path down to, well, there isn't enough specificity. If that's the conclusion of the court, then I think the appropriate result from the court is to say, send this back on summary judgment because we disagree that language is clear and unambiguous. And then you shouldn't decide it on summary judgment. You should have testimony on that point. I don't believe you have to do that analysis. The point that I was trying to make is that if you conclude that the language in the purchase agreement is ambiguous, then your result is not. And basically, I think that the court just skipped that whole step, didn't really decide that it was ambiguous or unambiguous. I believe it's unambiguous. That's the point I'm trying to make. But if you disagreed, then the remedy shouldn't be the district court is upheld. The remedy should be this is sent back for the district court to resolve what did the parties mean in this contract.
And whether it's ambiguous is a question of law, is that right?
I believe it is. And I believe that this court reviews the district court's decision de novo under the circumstances.
Just for my clarity, what was the duration of the telecommunications easement that preceded the Gulf Holdings easement?
I know it expired in 2026. I don't recall when it was established off the top of my head. I'd have to pull that, Your Honor.
You would agree it wasn't a 100-year agreement. I mean, whatever it was much shorter in duration than the one that Gulf Holdings now holds.
I believe it was shorter in duration. I have a recollection from the record that I thought it was that it predated my clients. So I don't think it was a short, like it wasn't like a 2-year or something lease.
Sure.
But I don't think it was 100 years either. I respectfully defer to whatever the record is on that point.
Did it also preclude the owners from contracting with any other party for a leased easement?
I don't know. I did not in detail review that
lease. Do we have that lease in our record?
That easement?
We're talking about the Midwest one.
The Midwest one. I believe that was submitted in the record. If you want me to try to look for it, I'm happy to do so.
Well, if you say it's there, I can dig around and try and find it.
And if it is there, it would inform us.
I guess it is.
Addendum 11.
Addendum 11. Yeah. Thank you.
And it would inform us, of course, as to any exclusivity.
Right. The one I'm looking at that I believe is the right one is 2001 to 2026. So it was a 25-year lease. As to the question about exclusivity, I'd have to read it in more detail, respectfully.
Well, thank you. Your time has expired. Thank you to both counsel for your written arguments and your oral arguments today. The